there's a lot of different definitions out there for trauma. The one that most aligns with my experience and makes the most sense for me is it's the absence of an empathetic witness in the face of annihilation. Annihilation is a strong word, and that is the experience of the person who is in the midst of trauma. It really is an encounter with death of sorts. And you feel as a person, your humanity is going to be annihilated. And it's the aloneness that adds so much harm to it.
Hagar's Voice is a movement and also a podcast that we want to call your attention to, mostly because it's a beautiful emerging movement that seeks to provide strategic support to survivors of clergy sexual abuse, as well as advocacy to change systems that perpetuate that abuse. So we're excited to be part of this Hagar's Voice movement. And as you've been listening to this podcast, hopefully you also will want to do something. So right away, you can begin to listen to Hagar's Voice podcast, which are the stories of survivors of clergy sexual abuse. That posture of listening and learning is easily practiced as you go and listen to survivors to tell their own stories, and you learn from that. Also, if you want to go to hagarsvoice.com, there are ways to support the movement coming. And we would love to have your support and spread the good news that Jesus really is on a mission to liberate. Okay, Anna, welcome to this season. And we are doing this episode on trauma specifically, and a little bit of your experience and your hope and your sharing and all the things that you've learned. Would you do us the privilege of telling us a little bit about who you are and what you're involved in and how you come to this podcast?
Sure. I'd be happy to. So I am a survivor myself. A little bit of my story is I found myself in an extremely traumatic situation. It was during the dissolution of my marriage, and I was showing up both at work and in my pastor's office in a state of utter devastation. And it was in that season that my vulnerabilities were exploited, and I was trapped in this sort of perpetual abuse cycle for about 6 months. And then on the heels of that, after I disclosed, there was the church that I was working for hired a law firm to put together an investigation. I participated wholeheartedly, feeling like I just want the truth to be known. And about, 3, 4, I don't remember, a handful of hours before they were going to disclose publicly the results of the investigation, I found out that, they were going to name it as consensual, and no part of my understanding of my experience felt like that was a true or honest statement. Since then, I've come to understand that a law firm should not be doing an investigation. Right. You need to have people who understand trauma and abuse dynamics. Certainly, legal counsel can be part of that process, but they just aren't equipped to do the job in a way that accurately explains or defines the experience.
And would you say, particularly, because this tracks with a lot of stories I know as well and have traveled with, that particularly the dynamics of clergy sexual abuse, so, you know, right. of church. So I know that people, you know, will often hire like workplace lawyers and go like, those rules apply in this situation, but it's really limited to how much that applies. It's a different dynamic in the church space.
It is a different dynamic in the church space. And I think just adding the spiritual component into all of it, lawyers aren't trained to address that. They're not trained to address spiritual abuse, spiritual harm. They're not really. And clergy sexual abuse in the States is illegal in 14 of them. So not even all states have laws that address this.
Right.
Additionally, when you add in the component of attorney-client privilege, and the fact that really the investigative firm is set up to protect the institution, mm-hmm. the chances of getting to a just or equitable outcome are just really minimal, even if the church goes into it desiring that, because they will feel pulled towards the protection of the institution at the expense of the victim almost every time.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you for sharing that distinction. I think that matters. So that brought you to just hours before this disclosure, you were like, okay, wow, they're going to say something that's not actually true.
Right.
And certainly not helpful to you.
Right. I very vocally told them I did not agree with it and I wanted them not to do it. And they pressed forward and did it anyway. And we're going to get into trauma, but I don't have adequate words to wrap around what that experience was like. It was utter devastation. And I lived in that space for months afterwards and continually trying to reach out to the leadership team to have a conversation with them. But they very much were in the mode of limiting liability. So they were not interested in a conversation. They just kind of wanted to move on.
Cause they're like, we dealt with this. We did what we could. What do you want from us?
Right.
And they're in total defensive mode.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And any conversation with me felt like, exposure to potential lawsuits. Mm-hmm. And, they were trying to protect themselves from that. Mm-hmm. So as you can imagine, that's devastating to someone, especially most clergy sexual abuse survivors give a large portion of their life to the church. They're in it pretty deep. And to be turned away like that and pushed out is really difficult. It's difficult to kind of wrap your head around.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's not just the abuse, which of course is this horrendous, life-defining and potentially life-ruining event. It's also the fallout from that, and betrayal is a strong term, but probably it's certainly a feeling of betrayal. We can debate as to whether it's betrayal. I think it's probably betrayal. I think it also speaks to, again, possibly this kind of privileged idea that, well, we'll get a lawyer and a lawyer will be objective and whatever the lawyer says will come out and that makes sense. And now we've done due diligence. And as you say, at the end of the day, a lawyer is going to protect their client. That is ultimately their job, not even being anti-lawyer particularly. They're doing the job they've been paid to do and they've protected their client, which is a job they've been paid to do. But obviously that means not protecting a victim, they're not going to do that because that's not what they've been hired to do. I can't be angry about McDonald's for not making me KFC chicken. That's not their job. That's not what they do, right? So in the same way, the lawyer isn't going to give a victim-centered approach a lot of the time.
Yeah, that feels really true.
Anna, can I ask you a question about this too? Because a lot of the victims that I've talked with about their story will say that their perpetrator basically told them that.
Yeah.
That part of the trap of the abusive cycle was a threat that was people will not believe you, like, right. Or some variety of like, this will cost you this community, this church, whatever.
Yeah.
And so there's also the double devastation of like them being right.
Yeah.
Those threats being true.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Even after all of this, there was a question asked of me. We don't understand, like being caught in that, we feel brokenhearted that you didn't feel like you had anybody to talk to about this. And having talked to many victims, I mean, disclosure, it's always months or years down the road. But what I would say is it's not safe to disclose. And until it's safe in churches to disclose, you can't, because the very thing that I was afraid of happening actually happened. Mm-hmm. And so, to just create space for survivors to safely disclose goes a long way.
So that was years ago? How long ago was that?
That was in January of 2021 when that was disclosed. So the next sort of chapter of my story was trying to find healing. Mm-hmm. And just first of all, trying to find language for what happened. Mm-hmm. I was fairly isolated. I didn't understand this or even have an awareness of this category of adult clergy sexual abuse. But things started to pop up online. The very first story that I heard was actually Lorianne Thompson's story. Mm-hmm. And I listened to her victim impact statement. And I knew then that's what happened to me. What she's describing is actually what happened to me. Mm-hmm. And then a few months later, I found a gal named Katie Roberts online, and she had done some podcasting and issued a public statement. And then again, I knew that's what happened to me. Mm-hmm. So I reached out to her. There was a whole group of survivors that began to meet together on Zoom. And then out of those meetings, we put together, formalized a nonprofit to help other survivors of adult clergy sexual abuse, because we found so much healing just in sitting with and talking through and feeling with each other as we each walked through the devastation that clergy sexual abuse is.
So you ended up creating a safe place.
We ended up
creating the very thing you lacked.
Yes. Creating.
Yeah, that's so beautiful.
Yeah. And it's been such a catalyst for healing for myself. Mm-hmm. And I know so many other victims in the process.
So people listening to this is Restored Voices. How do people get in touch with you? Or if they know somebody, how does somebody get in touch with Restored Voices?
Sure. You can send us an email, info@restoredvoicescollective.com. And I would say, knowing the perspective of a survivor, we hold confidentiality very seriously. We will never disclose on your behalf. You can show up with your camera off, with your microphone off. Really, your safety, your emotional safety, is the very first priority when we engage together. And there will be a real life person who can talk you through all this and answer questions and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Thank you for it. It's a beautiful work. Full circle to just this last weekend. A lot's happened. Catch us up to the end of that story. And then we're going to go through the effects of trauma and how trauma is a part of this thing. Sure. And we have to pay attention to that. So.
Sure. In an effort to get my voice heard, I continue to try and reach out to the elder board. It took them some time. It was a whole year before they were willing to engage in conversation with me. And from that time forward, we started meeting regularly. And another thing about me is currently I'm going to graduate school to get a counseling psychology degree. So I have a lot of access to this sort of information. I was able to find language and explain the dynamics of this sort of abuse. They were able to ask questions and really understand the framework that makes this abuse so incredibly damaging and destructive. So in that process, we established trust and we grieved together. And there was so much healing in that process. It took about 10 months to get to the point where they were willing and able to issue a public statement of both apology and a corrected narrative that accurately describes what happens in all of this. So I guess for your listeners, I know that largely there's a portion of them who are church leaders. I just want to encourage you, if this is part of your story, if clergy sexual abuse is part of your story and it has not been handled in a way that honors the voice of the victim, you can go back and make amends. You can do what it takes to set this right. And there can be a lot of healing, not only for the victim, but also for you and your leadership team and for your congregation.
Yeah, that's really hopeful. And also the kind of I don't know what the courageous, miraculous strength it would have taken you to keep engaged is something to behold. Like, I'm like, how did you do that? I don't know where you access that. Well, I do know where you access that power, but man, yeah. Wow.
What? Yeah. Thank you, Danielle. It was just kind of a put one step in front of the other. And in order for myself to heal, I had to understand what happened to me. Mm-hmm. So the educating of myself was really, really important. And then the ability to educate others was just kind of a natural byproduct of that. Mm.
Thanks for doing it and saying that and modeling hopefulness that way. I'm interested, did the realization of what had been done wrong or what had been left out or the omission or the process, did it affect the consequences for the perpetrator at all? Was there any sort of revisit of that?
He resigned right away when I disclosed. And I've purposely not asked a lot of questions about what I don't even know what he's doing. I know that he still lives in the area, but I don't even know what he's doing. I do know that they gave him the statement before it was read, but I don't know what his response was. I don't know if he is willing to own the impact of his actions. So that's a good question. I've purposely been kind of out of the loop as far as what's going on with him.
Yeah. So you were able to distinguish the difference between your perpetrator and safety from, and this conversation with your faith community and ongoing. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. That's interesting. Yeah. Okay. Now talk us through trauma with your edge. Thank you. First of all, thanks for your example and thanks for sharing so transparently. It really matters. I think the more we can hear from survivors about what this means, what this does, how this works, how this impacts, the better, the more informed we become. So, you know, your story is really powerful. Thank you. Let's go through it. So we hear this trauma-informed, not trauma-informed. We hear it dropped everywhere all the time and people use it to shame people and scare people. And so let's just have the conversation. What is trauma?
Oh, it's a loaded conversation for sure. And such an important concept to understand. Mm-hmm. For those who engage in ministry, those who show up in the midst of suffering, and just those who want to be a good friend and a good neighbor. I think in engaging with the work that I'm engaging in, there's a lot of different definitions out there for trauma. The one that most aligns with my experience and makes the most sense for me is, it's the absence of an empathetic witness in the face of annihilation. Annihilation is a strong word, and that is the experience of the person who is in the midst of trauma. It really is an encounter with death of sorts. Mm-hmm. And you feel as a person, your humanity is going to be annihilated. And it's the aloneness that add so much harm to it.
Which I think that definition of trauma is also very, well, I hope alarming in the best possible word, in the best possible way to people who, you know, and again, this, we hear this from survivors all the time, is like the trauma that keeps happening.
Yeah.
With a lack of an empathetic witness. Like, so it's happening within the actual event itself. So the abuse itself is this death, this isolation, this, what's a word I use a lot. I hear a lot is soul destroying.
Yeah.
Is that the essence of yourself is literally being destroyed in abuse.
Yeah.
But then it happens again and again in not finding any empathetic witness to that death.
Yeah. Many survivors will say that the abuse they endured in the actual sexual abuse is equal to the abuse, the spiritual abuse and trauma that comes post-disclosure when it's mishandled. Mm-hmm. And that truth, that reality can't be overstated for those who need to engage in stories of trauma. How you respond in this position of witness or lack of witness really matters, really matters.
What was the best response?
The best response has come from my close friends who are, they're just in it with me. And it's not a posture of fixing. It's just a posture of witnessing. It's a posture of being with, because the impact of trauma really touches on three categories. It's easy to remember. It touches on a timeline. It touches on your body and how you experience it. And it touches on your ability to communicate your words. So time, body, and words. And when you're sitting with someone who's in the midst of trauma, there's some things happening. So it is kind of stuck in their body. This experience, this too muchness, mm-hmm. It's what remains after death happens. It is stuck in their body and it doesn't get discharged. And then there's a block in your limbic system for the experience to get to your prefrontal cortex, which means that you don't have language for it. You can't articulate what is happening in your body. And then as time marches on, whatever is kind of left in that experience, it's not integrated, that the stuff that's stuck in your body gets re-experienced in new ways as if no time has gone by. And then I would add to further impact time, your future is also affected because you plan your life in a way to not get re-triggered by the past trauma, to try and avoid it. Wow. So it's this thing that you are constantly trying to avoid that is unavoidable.
This is something that I think is helpful to people too. And maybe one of the reasons why I think there's been a bit of a wave of disclosure is the realization that trauma does not heal over time.
Yeah.
And this is one of the great, I think, re-traumatizing things people have done to themselves and to each other, where we're just like, just give it time.
Yeah.
You know, and we've had, you know, I've had survivors who have suffered with this death of their soul and their personhood for 50, 60 years, who are suddenly now going, that's what this is.
Yeah.
This is, and the release of that, like when you can process the trauma, when you can get it out of your body and into your words and out of your, you know, when you can say it, it matters so much. I mean, it is so powerful.
It does matter. And Danielle, I've had similar experiences. 20 years can go by between the time you were abused and the time when you're sitting in therapy and you're beginning to develop words around this bodily experience. And as they start coming out, it's not an immediately healing process. In fact, it's whatever was unknown about that experience is actually re-experienced again. And so the trauma survivor in the process of healing has to do so much work in going back through and re-experiencing until they get to a point where it can be integrated. You mentioned what we like to tell trauma survivors is give it some time. And that is true. It is not healed with time. Diane Langberg has a framework of talking, tears, and time. So you have to process it. Time is a component. It takes time to get through it. Yeah. But unless there's a processing of it that happens through the talking about it and the feeling it, the tears part of it, it's not resolved. It doesn't just kind of go away.
There's always this kind of rush to platitudes. And I wonder, I think a lot of the time to be like generous to people that just don't know what to say. So, like, well, I've got to say something. So I'll say something that someone said to me and was it helpful? And so, well, time heals all wounds. Well, again, neurologically, it doesn't. So can we just like, let's just start there. Let's just start with the fact our knowledge of brain chemistry means that, again, so time and a bunch of other things might heal some wounds. Like let's go with that.
Oh, true.
And it was something we just rush to these kind of easy, pithy answers without, because it's actually way harder, right? So, well, you know, maybe you'll feel less bad tomorrow. Like, well, I'm not gonna. I think you're saying even, yeah, we don't have language to process. That's how the brain processes trauma. So let's just sit in that for a while. The idea of being, I think this is another thing with victims, well, why didn't you tell us? Why didn't you say it? Why didn't you put it in the right way? It's like, because I cannot. Like, our brains are not wired in the way that I can do that. And so just being informed, and this is informative for me as well. So just being informed of those pieces and being more charitable and generous and patient, I think is so key here to understanding, what being trauma-informed is. And it seems like, yeah, understanding just how it affects our brain chemistry is huge.
Yeah. You mentioned the word patience. I think that there's so much information packed in that word for those who do desire to witness and help others heal from trauma. When you're sitting with a trauma survivor who doesn't have access to language, it's very much embodied, and that's really uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so to be the person on the other side who is not quick to go to platitudes and to make it better, but instead to say, all feelings are welcome here. Whatever you need to show up with right now, that is welcome here. And it's welcome here for as long as it needs to be welcome. That there doesn't need to be a rush to get to the end. We're gonna kind of saunter our way through all states of feelings, and it's welcome and it's okay.
Anna, did you find in your experience that once you did that, now, did your processing, you mentioned friends who could be there with you and in it, counseling, did you get therapy? Like, is that where some of this processing of the trauma happened?
Oh, my therapist was so helpful. When I did finally disclose to him, he was the very first one to name it as abuse. I don't know that he had categories for exactly clergy sexual abuse or adult clergy sexual abuse, but he knew from what I was explaining to him that this was abusive. So yes, 100%. His witness of my trauma throughout this whole thing has helped so much in the healing process, and really gave me a framework for finding language for it that was in proper categories and helped me to process and integrate it at the end of the day. So important.
Did you find once you had the language that it was like another phase of healing? Like, absolutely. Then you moved into actually using that language. Like,
yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. In that investigation process, mm-hmm. I showed up to the interview, barely even being able to put language around my experience. That would be another component. You need to understand trauma to the degree of engaging in an interview when you're coming out of abuse is like, what you're going to get is just kind of a sliver. Disclosures typically happen in progression. I think the prevailing wisdom with survivors, especially of this type of abuse, would be to be in trauma and abuse-informed therapy for some time before you're able to disclose, because you need to have a firm understanding and access those words. Mm-hmm. And that just takes time. It doesn't happen right away. My particular situation didn't lend itself to that. And I know many survivors don't get that luxury of having time to make sense of their story before they have to disclose. But that's just kind of another way. If you don't understand how trauma works, you are going to misunderstand someone else's experience and do a lot of harm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the unique characterization of trauma from suffering. Like, how is trauma different from suffering?
Yeah. So, suffering, if you kind of view suffering, it's something that you can metabolize. So it happens and you can make sense of it. and it gets integrated into your neurobiology. So it's not something that feels separate or that you don't understand. It's outside of your experience. And ultimately, like you said, it gets integrated. Think of it like a wound that it might have a scab over it, but it's healing. Whereas, or a scar even, a traumatic experience is like an open wound that never heals. It's kind of always there. And every time it gets bumped, it hurts again in the same way that it hurt before. So that's maybe a different categorization of trauma.
And if you have an open wound, you move differently, right? If I've got an open wound on my hand, I'm not going to use that hand. And in the same way, the way we kind of think about open wounds with regards to abuse, well, the way I move is going to be different. The places I put myself is going to be different. I don't want to expose that part of myself. Like this, it just impacts so much, so profoundly, so often.
Absolutely. And a lot of survivors will describe this particular type of wound like an amputation. So if you think of an amputation that is not scarred over, is an open wound, of course you're going to orientate your whole life in order to avoid re-injuring that or re-aggravating it, or you're going to protect it. And that's part of post-traumatic stress syndrome, is a desire to avoid any trigger of that event, any memory of it. So you don't go to the same places you went before. That's largely why survivors have such a hard time going back to church, is so much of the abuse happened in church. So you put your life back together in a way as to not bump into that injury anymore.
What did trauma look like in your story of clergy sexual abuse?
First off, I think for me, in figuring out what happened to me, is it was a very new experience for me. My marriage ended suddenly, and it was the betrayal of both my husband and my best friend at the time, which was really traumatic. And that was my first sort of introduction to the category of trauma. And that's how I showed up to clergy sexual abuse in that state. So in all the ways we're talking about not having language, it being stuck in your body, that's where I was in my person when this all started.
And so hang on right there. So that pre-existing trauma kind of is this like catalyst almost, seems to be so prevalent in most clergy sexual abuse accounts.
Yep, absolutely.
Do you think that whether or not it's a known predatory instinct or whether or not that's just what clergy abusers, like clergy sexual abusers do, like the predatory nature of the act of clergy sexual abuse, where they're looking for that trauma in order to exploit it?
I think it all plays into it. What we know about perpetrators of clergy sexual abuse is largely they're middle-aged, they're semi-successful, they're doing okay in their job. The initiation of the abuse usually comes at a time when they're overwhelmed and they would describe themselves as powerless. And in an effort to regain power, they find someone to power over. Narcissistic tendencies also are a theme in this type of abuse. And with that, there is an attraction to vulnerability. So you're absolutely right. Most clergy sexual abuse survivors show up with pre-existing trauma. In some of David Pooler's work, I know that he has articulated that as well. So that is accurate.
Which is also just another good like shout out here to try to address trauma with help with certified, if you can, if it's possible, wherever you possibly can, or even survivors. So something like Restored Voices could maybe help you navigate that space, even if you're not there yet. But even if it's a any trauma, to address it and to try to get it integrated and then potentially healed is going to be absolutely important, even as a preventative measure for future trauma.
Yeah. And I think what you're articulating right now, Danielle, is really important for the victim and the survivor. I also think it's so important systemically. Mm-hmm. So as churches cover over this or try to move on from it without actually addressing the culture and systemic issues, what we would like to believe is if we take out a bad character, the system can continue to operate and we can find health again. But the truth is that this type of abuse exists in a system, and you really do need to understand systemically the source of that trauma, because in the same way that it's reenacted in the survivor, when it comes back and those things that are unknown are re-experienced, there's a tendency for it to come back in systems as well, institutional systems. So to do the story work of understanding how you got to where you are in order to prevent it moving forward. And it's painful in a similar way that it's not comfortable to sit with survivors in their embodied trauma. It's not comfortable to sit with a body of people and really unpack the trauma in order to integrate it and heal. But that is the process of healing, is we have to talk about it so that it can be integrated.
Wow. This is almost corporate trauma therapy.
Yeah.
Like in a way, right?
Yeah. And it's we have to figure out what was in place that allowed it to happen to begin with.
Yeah. And otherwise we'll perpetuate it without even knowing. Yeah.
Right. Yep. If we pull back, we can see this in things like wars. When a new war starts, it's largely addressing things that were unaddressed from the previous war.
Right.
So, Yeah. You take it from the individual all the way to systems, all the way to culture, all the way to on a global level, and unaddressed trauma gets reenacted and re-shows up. And it needs to be integrated. Mm,
that's great. So you had a pre-existing trauma. So that's part of the trauma trait. If you're tracing trauma in your storyline, you have a pre-existing trauma. Then you have the actual abuse that happened.
Yeah. Yep. So what trauma looked like then, when I was unpacking my story with the elders, there was, so in our sort of awareness system, we have a place where hyper arousal. So if we're going to attach numbers from 1 to 10, this would be like 7 to 10. You're in a state where your prefrontal cortex is offline. You're largely looking for threat. So you're in the fight, flight, or freeze zone, where you're very concerned with threat. And then in the mid range, so like if we're talking about numbers like 4 to 7, somewhere in there, that's where we are right now, where we can think and we can talk and we can engage in relationship and use our capacity to move about life in a way that makes sense. And then on the lower range, from 1 to 3 or 4, is like that's where we fawn or we shut down. Think of animals when the hyper arousal, the fight or flight doesn't work, they play dead. So this is where your system essentially just shuts down. And there was many times during the abuse where that was my embodied experience. I remember my legs getting really heavy and my arms getting really heavy. I was really tired and just feeling like cemented in one spot. So that's what my experience of that was largely like, and it was really confusing. I didn't understand why I couldn't make this thing stop that I didn't want to stop. On this side of it, understanding how trauma works, I get it now. And having talked to dozens of survivors, it's a pretty pervasive experience with trauma. There's a really interesting study done about sexual harassment. And the people who participated in the study ahead of time were asked, you know, if somebody were saying these inappropriate things to you, what would be your response? And of course they were like, well, I would tell them it wasn't okay. And I would get up and leave and I would do whatever it took to get out of the situation. The next phase of the study was in simulating interview situations. And the interviewer, who's in a position of power, started to engage in conversation that was clearly inappropriate. And almost across the board, the people who were being interviewed tried to play nice. They tried to laugh it off. It's confusing. Is this me? Is this you? This doesn't feel like something that you should be doing, but I don't know. So the response to get out of it felt too big for them to engage with. So they shut down and they just kind of endured it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. That's really good. That's part of the awareness of trauma. That's really important because those are some of the biggest questions people have is if it was so bad, you know, why didn't you leave? Or why didn't you say something sooner? Or why didn't you, and people don't realize the way trauma is, especially with the power in indifference, the way trauma really affects your nervous system, like your whole, you just are not the person that you normally would be. There's something else going on.
Right. And in all sexual abuse, whether it happens in childhood or later, it is the goal of the perpetrator to get the victim to turn towards them. And this act of turning towards them is a source of so much confusion. And it's a source of so much self-blame because after the abuse happens, you look back to that moment and you are angry with yourself. You don't understand. But there is a playing on vulnerability that that happens, and it's very intentional, and it's part of being human. Like we respond to wanting a sense of belonging, wanting a sense of safety, wanting a sense of being seen and known. And perpetrators are really good at seeing their victims and seeing the ways in which their needs are not being met and show up in order to meet those needs. And so with this type of abuse, it's really important to understand that component, both from the victim perspective, but also from those who are walking with the victim, because that's intentional and it's part of the abuse.
And that can look like anything from, you know, so spending a lot of time and consideration, affirming, connecting, sure, meaningful, engaging. And then there's a twisting.
Yeah.
And then the twisting, which usually is like in the most part in this specific thing, is when we turn all those things are all turned by the perpetrator into a sexual situation that is unwanted, but is using all of these, you know, things that have been built up. And then in the turning, then begins to also turn the emotional support to themselves.
Yep.
So the turning goes, I've been there for you. Now I need you to be there for me. Or you're the only one who understands me. Or you're the only one that I can. So it's like the whole thing is kind of hinges on this like emotional investment. And then it's like a twisting of that emotional investment to then receive from that person, whether they want it or not. Is that fair to...
So fair to say. Yeah. The sort of hinge in my own story was exactly that when I was clearly barely functional and he asked me to care for him in his story. And because of the wounding and hurt that I had come from, of not feeling like I was doing a good job of caring, there was a need to care for him in order to make me okay, just with my own story. But what I, in order to kind of create some framework for understanding, if you were going to a dentist because you are in pain, dental pain, tooth pain, you're expecting a certain engagement with that dentist. They're going to address your pain. And the betrayal in clergy sexual abuse is that you show up expecting spiritual care. You show up expecting healing in emotional and spiritual ways. And that gets twisted. The betrayal is that you're not actually here for that. You are here to meet my needs. And that's part of the trauma of all of it, is you're engaging with this person as if you're engaging with a professional who has a responsibility to provide certain things for you. And that's not his intention at all at the end of the day.
And to riff on that example, I think it really illuminates how ridiculous it is. Because if you went to a dentist and he was like, all right, I'm going to lie down and here's a, I don't know, right, drill and an anesthetic, and you've got to, what is happening here? Yeah. Like, this is the thing.
I've got a tooth that's really hurting me. I don't know what to tell you.
I'm sorry. That's not what this dynamic is. That's not the expectation. That's not the power. Like, that's not what any of this is about. But again, it does absolutely highlight how ridiculous it is and how quickly we normalize that, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But in any other kind of professional, so again, I have a counselor, and if she just said, James, you know what? Like, you're just going to have to listen to me for this hour. I'd be like, oh, I don't know what to do with this.
Right. And you've built a relationship with your counselor over how many hours? And there's a part of you that feels like, really? Well, you know. So the confusion that you guys are communicating right now is a very embodied experience of not knowing how to engage with this sort of request for the role reversal. Mm.
So you had this pre-existing trauma that then was cultivated and kind of catalytic, predatory wise, like someone was looking for that in order to then re-traumatize you with the actual abuse.
Right.
And then you have a third kind of trauma event in the disclosure.
Yep. In that same exact response, in those hours before I found out what they were going to say, I had like my whole person collapsed. I have neighbors and close friends who sat with me through that. But it's like a barely functional state. Unless and until you've sat with someone who's there, it's hard to explain. It's hard to understand, but it makes the world really hard to make sense of. Another way that is helpful for me when I'm thinking about this is if you think about a snow globe, and it's like a traumatic event happens and the snow globe gets shaken up. And if you picture the snow that's floating around as you don't have any categories for any of it. It's a really confusing experience. And so your language is inadequate. You're just kind of stuck in this storm of snow that's blowing around. And until the snow can fall down and then you can kind of sweep it up and put it into its proper categories, it doesn't get integrated. So in that experience of disclosure, of the elder board disclosing to the congregation, that's what it was like, because my embodied experience of what I had just walked through was nothing like what they were going to be explaining to in a very public sense to the congregation. So it was impossible for me to picture life after that. Like what are the categories for life on the other side of what's just about to happen?
When we were thinking about this before we came into this episode, you had put it like this: the abuse was, I was expecting care, but the vulnerabilities that I brought were exploited. And so I was lost my agency, lost my voice, and it was entrapment. I was stuck.
Yeah.
And then when this disclosure happened without your permission and without truth, you know, mm-hmm. in a false way. You had also expected care in the disclosure, but you were met instead with institutional protectionism.
Yeah.
And a lack of education. So those two things together. So whether it was willful or whether it was ignorant, the causal effect is the same, which is what I keep telling people. I don't really care if you're ignorant. You did the thing. It caused the harm. Like, you still have to own the damage. And that was, then you put, that was annihilation.
Yep.
That was just reading that for me, you know, sort of that idea of one was entrapment. I felt I lost my agency. I lost my voice. But this third, you know, trauma, and maybe it's because they're in sequence. Maybe it's one trauma, another trauma, another trauma, and it becomes like annihilation, or maybe just that final trauma is just so,
I think it's both. I think the culmination of everything I had lived through in that year, there was a too muchness that you can't really put a frame around. Another way that's helpful for me to understand this is in the Christian narrative of crucifixion to resurrection. There's this middle, Holy Saturday. And if you think about it from the disciples' perspective, they had expectations of Jesus. They had expectations of how life was going to be with him and through him. And that was all destroyed during the crucifixion. And they didn't have an understanding of what the resurrection would look like. Mm-hmm. There was just an absence. There was an absence of his voice, an absence of his presence. And you also sense that, like, I don't understand what just happened. I don't have categories for it. I'm just living and existing in this space that happens after death, the remainder of what's there after death. Mm-hmm. And there's just a silence to it. There's a deadness to it that really does feel like an ongoing ending, an ongoing death that doesn't quite resolve itself.
Mm. Wow. This, your story, this example, even just your tenacity at discovery, self-discovery and healing. And then of course, this beautiful thing going on through you of like reaching out and creating something for others and making safe places in the world. And then your tenacity to actually keep educating people who I would be like, should go educate themselves already. Like, your grace in that space is just breathtaking. I'm learning so much from you, and we are indebted for you to tell this story with such bravery and grace. Thank you. Any sort of last words, maybe to survivors that might be listening to this, or people who know survivors, sort of last things you want to say?
Yeah. To survivors specifically, there's help and there's healing, and it feels so dark and it feels so impossible. And the path towards that is people, engaging with people who really understand and are willing to sit with you through that. So don't give up on that quest. Keep looking and find safe places to tell your story. And there's discernment in knowing what's safe and what's not safe. And you don't owe your story to anybody. Mm-hmm. But when you find a safe place, do engage, and there's hope and there is healing.
I think it's really important. I really want to hammer on that again, that if things don't feel better, even though lots of time has passed, that I don't mean it's okay, but that's not a surprise. Like, as you say, that time and talking and tears, time is just one thing that needs to allow healing to take place. But again, much like plants need water and sunlight, maybe some other things, but like, if you keep You can give a plant all the sunlight in the world. If you don't give it water as well, the thing isn't going to survive. And so I think that's so important that people know they're not busted just because, but it's been a long while. And when other people may have said unhelpful things as well and said, well, it's been a long while. Like, yeah, but that's only one of the things that is needed for healing to take place there. I think that's so important for us to hold in this moment.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I just want to add not only just thanks, but also to people who are listening who might be part of church leadership or boards or elders or pastors. Please, please get trauma-informed. Start the work now. You know, do you have any favorite places to begin, Anna, for people who just need to catch up on this journey?
Because I think there's some people out there that want to be trauma-informed, but just assume they know, and then sometimes they don't. So let's say that that point of awareness of going, maybe I don't know. What are some things I need to know I know I don't know?
Or they think I need a PhD in it.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Or it doesn't count. So right. What are the ways people begin moving in this direction?
I think that the most trauma-informed thing that you could do is become a student of the person who needs healing. They hold their story and they are the expert in their story. And we need to learn and listen from them, really create safe places for them to tell their story, create safe places that allow for messiness. That's probably the biggest thing that I would say, that the most trauma-informed approach that you can take is don't be afraid of survivors of trauma and engage with them in a way that is that has a curious posture. And the last thing I would add is don't be afraid to pull in people who are formally trained in this. If you're desiring to walk through a reconciliation process with a survivor, it makes total sense to bring in a third party who understands trauma and understands the process in order to create an environment where it's contained, a containing environment. Mm-hmm. So there's resources out there that can help you. You don't need to be the expert, but I do think that to engage somebody who is an expert is wise. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Anna. We really appreciate it. We're grateful for you. Glad that you are healing and also a healer and offering what you've known using your experience that the enemy intended for harm, using it for some good in the world. We're really thankful.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you for your work. It's so encouraging.
Thank you. We'll keep at it together, huh?
Yep. Sounds good.